Curriculum Associates presents the Extraordinary Educators Podcast with hosts Danielle Sullivan and Sari Liberis. Hear tips, best practices, and successes to improve your teaching and leadership and drive student growth and learning. We're here for you.
Hi, everyone. It's Danielle. And welcome to the Extraordinary Educator Podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Sari, and this week we are joined by the one and only Dr. Ray Reutzel. Dr. Ray is a senior research fellow in the Center for School of the Future at Utah State University and a faculty member and former dean of the College of Education at University of Wyoming. He served as an author and advisor to research validated programs, including iReady, Magnetic Reading Foundations, and Magnetic Reading. He is also the author of more than 235 published research reports, articles, book chapters, and monographs, and has received more than $17 million in external funding. He's a member of the Reading Hall of Fame and served as its president from 2017 to 2019.
And it was so great talking with him because I am a huge research nerd and it was really, really fun. So I think you'll enjoy it too.
Welcome, Dr. Ray. We are so excited to have you here today.
Great to be here with you. Excited.
Thanks so much. So we're just going to dive right in to start. Can you please explain the difference between the science of reading and the science of reading instruction?
Well, I'll do my best. The difference between the two lies in the type of research base that supports each. Science of reading is supported by a large, evolving database of basic research that's been coming about for about 40 years now. And basic research is research into human cognitive functions and has no implications for practice per se, because the work was not done to learn what practices work with teaching people. It has to do with how the human brain actually does this thing called reading, or the processes the brain does to process text information. So that's science of reading. It's a big body of research that's been amassing for decades, and it's basic research that tells us how the mind functions. Science of reading, on the other hand, is another body of research. And this body is what we call applied research, meaning that this research was done to investigate how we might more effectively teach humans this thing called reading or writing. And so it's applied, usually field-based research, typically done in clinics or classrooms or small group settings, for example, with special education students. So these are applied studies with students, with teachers, that tell us about whether or not a particular strategy or intervention or program or assessment actually works when taken into the arena where it should be practiced. And those are the differences. Now, some people conflate the two, just say science of reading and leave off the instruction, say, you know, that it includes everything. That's not a very tidy and exacting way to refer to the two, because they are different types of research and different bodies of research.
That's really interesting. Can you tell us why it takes more than just one research study or for a learning or a practice to qualify for the science of reading or science of reading instruction? Can you kind of dissect that a little bit more?
Oh, sure, certainly. Everybody that I talk to in education has kind of an attitude that I've run across with research. It's, you can say anything with statistics. You can make research say anything, which is, to some extent true if you're relying on a single study, because a single study can be an outlier and you wouldn't know it. You may think that this is telling you the gosh awful truth about things. And it may not be. It may be dead wrong. And we see this in education a lot of times with a mixed bag of studies. You know, over time, some say it works, some say something doesn't. And, you know, we end up with very small effect sizes as a result. And so we usually don't say that represents the science of reading. So it takes multiple studies converging on the same finding. Now, it may not be as strong in terms of effect size, but it's headed in the same direction. And we do that replication in order to avoid making mistakes by relying on a single data point. We, you know, most classroom teachers know this, that a single test score is not a good decision-making criteria. And it's the same with research. A single study is not a good decision-making criteria.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for clarifying that for us. Switching gears a bit, in our recent webinar series, The Science of Reading, Putting Research into Action, which we'll link in the show notes for those listeners who want to watch it, you shared deeply researched science of reading instructional practices, and you mentioned educators who are trying to put the science of reading research into action and how they should do so both horizontally across classrooms and then vertically across grade levels and different content areas. So if we're thinking about our listeners and how they're going to be, you know, with their students, and how also science of reading is just such a buzzword right now. And there's a gap between understanding like the abstract concepts and then actually applying it in the classroom with students. So for our listeners, when they have students in front of them tomorrow, what are three things that teachers can focus on to really start this work?
Well, I'll rely on some of the work that my colleague Timothy Shanahan has done. Tim's good friend, and he was double dog dared after being on the national reading panel to go into the Chicago schools and be the reading czar for the district for a year. And Tim made only three big changes. That's all there was. And it resulted in a year later, the district posting the highest reading scores they'd ever had in history and the largest single year in growth they had ever seen.
Wow.
So I think I'll rely on his research to give this information to teachers. Because I'm one of those people who likes to rest my opinions on research when I can.
We concur wholeheartedly with that.
Okay. So first thing is, Tim talks about time, and time being the most important single variable teachers have control over. You know, how much time are you allocating for reading instruction? Is it enough? Tim recommends 120 minutes a day. And that's what they did. K-12 in the Chicago public schools that year, 120 minutes a day. He recommends that you divide that time among four essential blocks of instruction. First, word identification, word work, 30 minutes. Another 30 minutes to developing fluency with reading. Another 30 minutes to vocabulary and comprehension work. And the final 30 minutes of the 120 minutes to writing. So that was the first thing. And then, of course, he talks about the need for time to be managed carefully, for instruction to be offered briskly, fast pacing, minimal transition times, all of those kinds of things we know about how to use time and use it well. Because teachers who get six practice events in over a teacher who gets three in the same time is going to have better achievement as a result of that, because the kids have had more guided practice. So time's a big one. Okay. And then, of course, the second item, which I've just already mentioned, is that you've got to allocate that time to the right stuff. And that was what I just talked about in those four blocks: word identification, fluency, writing, and vocabulary comprehension work. And then the third thing he says is get a program, get a scope and sequence, a curriculum, a program. He's fairly agnostic about it. And because what teachers need is something to guide their work without having to spend every night burning the midnight oil, writing their own curriculum and their own lessons all the time. So get a curriculum and get everybody cross grades, vertically and horizontally, to be using that curriculum, especially for teaching phonics, so that you get some systematic approach to what you're doing, so that you can diagnose if everybody's doing this and it isn't working, then we tweak it this way or that way. We can start to actually diagnose the system and fix it. And so having some kind of a program or programs underneath your instruction is a good idea. And then the third thing that he does is bring in a lot of professional development, like we're doing right now. Okay. Teachers need that kind of support, because I can't think of a teacher preparation program in the country right now that has an undergraduate course in educational research and research consumption. If you're going to get research training, you usually go to a master's degree program in education. And that's kind of a sad situation when you think about it, because we're asking people who come out of baccalaureate programs and go into the classroom as teachers to be doing their work based on evidence, but they don't even know where the evidence is or how to access it. And if they did access it, how to make sense of it. That seems kind of, my opinion as a former dean of education, sort of malpractice.
Definitely.
So those are just some quick things that you can think about. You know, allocate enough time, use that time wisely, allocate it to the right stuff, and then get some sort of a scope and sequence and program underneath you to support you as you move forward with that time.
Thank you for that. That's very clear, very helpful, and especially it's very systematic too. And that's what we're seeing universally when it comes to other implementations of even how to effectively use data is time. It's building the time, mm-hmm. building in the right systems. Mm-hmm. So I know there's been a lot of focus on foundational skills when we talk about the science of radiant instruction. I would love for to know your thoughts. Are there any other topics we want to think about considering the science of reading and the science of reading instruction?
Well, I'll give you at least a couple, if not more, depending on how much time we have.
We have as much time as you would like to share, as much time as it needs.
Yeah. Number one is that most teachers, when they get involved with phonemic and phonological awareness, are spending way too much time on teaching it. If you look deeply into the literature on this, you will see that the National Reading Panel reported that after 20 hours of instruction, the time spent teaching PA, whether it's phonological or phonemic awareness, begins to degrade. In other words, the learning curve starts to drop, so it's not effective. So if you think about the fact you've got 20 hours of instructional time strung out over kindergarten and first grade, your lessons are going to be pretty brief. They should be about 4 to 5 minutes. And most curricula that teachers are adopting that I've seen lately have like 20-minute lessons. Well, then you would be done with phonemic awareness, you know, by Christmas in kindergarten, which doesn't make sense because the buildup over time really should be through kindergarten and into first grade for those types of skills that build from all the way from being able to recognize how many words are in a sentence all the way to being able to substitute, delete sounds and manipulate sounds in language. So that's one thing, too much time on those lessons. Make them brief, get right to it. Another thing that we found with the phonemic awareness, phonological awareness game is rhyming really doesn't pay much of a dividend, nor does alliteration. The real money is in phonemic awareness, and the real money in phonemic awareness is in blending and segmenting. All the other things around that you hear about helping with PA, phonological or phonemic awareness, really doesn't add much to the effect size. If you look into the National Reading Panel, you will see very, very quickly that the effect size for blending and segmenting is about 0.76, if I remember right in that number. And if you just took everything else away and just did blending and segmenting, the effect size stays at 6.7. So that means that all the other stuff is adding about 0.09 to the effect size, which is not really a good way to spend your time. So I tell teachers, if you've got to dump something off your plate, and most teachers feel like that would be a blessing to de-implement something and get focused and do a little less to get a little more, focus your PA on blending and segmenting most of your time. Get there fast and do a lot of it until the kids are good at it. And then the last thing I might add is letter name pacing of instruction. This is a big thing that I did research on with my colleague, Cindy Jones. And we were very dissatisfied with the letter a week game that you see in a lot of programs. And what we found was if you teach a letter a day using a lesson framework that we developed that takes about 12 minutes a day, you can get much, much better results at the end. Quite large differences, like from the difference would be like 43% of your kids getting marked proficient on the Dibbles letter name fluency test to, you know, getting over 80% of your kids benchmarked. And so that's a pretty huge difference, but doing a letter a day and doing multiple repetitions of those letters throughout the year instead of only one time hitting A and then maybe getting back to it in March and getting half the alphabet by the time you're done with kindergarten again. That does not tend to produce the same kinds of results. So there's little tweaks that I'm offering, you know, to do less, focus more, do a little different, and you can get some really big differences for your kids.
Thanks so much for sharing those. It's so interesting that such a small tweak can, you know, result in such great gains. But I think that makes it even more the reason to just change those small things in the classroom so that ultimately student learning and success is is performing at higher levels.
Yeah, so. We just got our data with a district we've been working with, and they have 6 elementary schools, and in their kindergarten, they only have 5 children who are in the red zone on Dibbles. out of 176.
Wow, that's amazing.
So I think we're seeing some real great results on the ground with real teachers in real schools. And this is an inner city school district, by the way, with a lot of diversity.
That's awesome. Congrats. And thank you so much for your time and for sharing all of this. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today, but really appreciate your insights. And I'm sure our listeners do too. So thanks again, Dr. Ray.
You bet. I hope they're helpful. Have a great day.
Get inspired by following us on social media, and please tag us in your posts on Twitter at @curriculumassoc and on Instagram at @myiready. If you have feedback about the podcast, a topic of interest, or want to be a guest, email extraordinaryeducators@caInc.com. Subscribe where you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to help more educators like you join the conversation, please leave a review.
Remember, be you, be true, be extraordinary. The Extraordinary Educator Podcast is produced by Curriculum Associates, editing by Whiteboard Geeks, social media by @CityHannon, guest booking by Sari Liberis, production by Haley Browning. This podcast is copyrighted materials and intellectual property of Curriculum Associates.